Measuring Success Right, the official podcast of the Marriott Student Review, a podcast for students by students, where we connect the leaders of tomorrow with the issues of today.
So if you're more like me, where you don't have a technical niche that excites you, then pay attention to what makes you feel good. You know, I don't mean sit at home and wait for inspiration. It'll never come without perspiration.
Welcome to Measuring Success Right. My name is Spencer McWilliams, and I'm your host for this episode. Today, we have the pleasure to talk to Brett Harris from MMI Industrial and Steel. Before we dive in, I'm just going to give a little introduction to Brett and all that he has done. So Brett Harris serves as the COO, or Chief Operating Officer, for MMI Industrial and Steel, which is a privately owned company based out of Arizona. Prior to MMI Industrial and Steel, Brett worked at Sunburst Shutters as the VP of Manufacturing and Director of Retail Expansion, and worked as a hotel manager at various locations in Utah and Las Vegas. Brett grew up just outside of Sacramento, California, and served as a missionary for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Haiti. He graduated from Brigham Young University with a bachelor's in travel and tourism, with an emphasis on hotel management. Brett and his wife Candace have been married for 28 years and have 5 children. Brett, welcome. We are delighted to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm honored to have been asked to participate. It's a pleasure to be with you, Spencer.
Yeah. So first off, it sounds like you have a lot of experience with serving in management positions in a variety of fields. You first majored in travel and tourism, but are currently working for a steel company. Could you tell us a little bit about your journey to MMI Industrial and Steel?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It was a unique adventure. I left BYU in 1994 with ambitions of being the next hotel tycoon. And so we moved from Provo to Las Vegas with one baby and a thin savings account to build a resume and just kind of plan to get out of Las Vegas within about 5 years. I had no mentors in the industry, and the internet was not yet a reliable resource for information. So it was just kind of something I wanted to do and frankly didn't know a whole lot about. Had someone told me that I was going to work every weekend and holiday and be paid like a circus Sullivan, I probably would have made other plans. I would not recommend that any of your listeners just up and move to Las Vegas to build a hotel career in the midst of a casino frenzy. The hotels in Las Vegas are elegantly designed, but they support gambling, and the hotels will always come second. I handled more customer service complaints in about 3 years in those hotels in Las Vegas than most would in a long career, and became an expert at diffusing volatile guests. You know, guests go to Las Vegas sometimes with some pretty rough intentions, and they're usually hungover and broke within about 48 hours, and I was the guy that they were trying to get money out of, before they went back home. But while that was a miserable experience, it was a valuable experience. Having that much opportunity to diffuse volatile guests was something that has served me well in my career. I transitioned from there into sales for a window covering company called Sunburst Shutters. They happen to have several BYU grads that participate in that company. And so I started in sales with them and really enjoyed some quick success. And the owner of that company became my first professional mentor. His name is Dix Jarman. His son, Price Jarman, played volleyball for BYU. He's got a son named Cooper who will come and play volleyball for BYU in a couple of years. And he unselfishly supported me in several endeavors and frankly trusted me with company growth I wasn't prepared for. It was just kind of a sink or swim kind of thing, you know. And I did my best. I made a lot of mistakes, and I learned from every one of them and had more successes than failures, but I was very fortunate to have someone give me a shot without a proven track record. I really enjoyed helping to establish a national wholesale program and take oversight of a manufacturing facility in central Wisconsin. It was the largest in the United States of its kind. And soon I was developing strategic retail markets around the country. I loved every minute of it. I worked with really progressive, engaging, competitive men and women, and it never felt like work until the recession took a nasty shot at me and at that company, and it was time for me to move on. So that is how I landed here at MMI. It's the steel fabricator, and when I got here, the people here just looked at me like I was a fish out of water. I wasn't wearing work boots. I didn't want to put on a harness and work 100 feet in the air. I certainly didn't want to climb steel. But the company wasn't in need of another welder. It just really needed structure and culture and strategic planning and marketing and so on. And those needs are universal. They're just needed at every company. And so that's where my expertise lies and what I enjoy doing. It's what I've been doing here for the last almost 10 years.
Yeah, that is definitely a journey from where you started and where you are now. And I think jumping in, especially when you moved from Utah to Las Vegas, like that must have been a great cultural change. And it kind of parallels from where you started off in hotel management to where you are now in a steel company, which must require like a lot of flexibility within your career, which it seems like it's opened up a lot of opportunities, especially within leadership. So for any emerging professionals, what advice would you give for them on having that kind of flexibility within their career?
Yeah, good question, Spencer. When I came out of school, not too long after I graduated from BYU, the dot-com bubble was just really strong. And I had several friends that were hitting it big. And software, the development of software, the sales of software is just not something that ever took with me. And I worried that I'd miss the boat because I had friends that were just killing it. And I was still trying to figure out who I was. So flexibility was something that was kind of thrust on me, I guess, because I wasn't finding specialty right away. It just took a little while for my flexibility to unveil itself to me. Where I feel particularly strong is in developing talent and enthusiasm within the company and then working with the partners that help to serve our business grow. So if you're more like me, where you don't have a technical niche that excites you, then pay attention to what makes you feel good. You know, I don't mean sit at home and wait for inspiration. It'll never come without perspiration. Just go and work hard and have good days and bad days. Something I was thinking about is I may have been able to expedite my journey had I kept some kind of a journal going back several years about what happened on the days that were great and what happened on the days that I didn't want to repeat. Understanding what you love and understanding what you really don't love helps you to find out who you are, you know?
Yeah.
I think you have to examine those differences and look for consistencies and then put the pedal down on what makes you really happy.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Journal writing has always been very hard to keep up with, but I think when we do look back on entries that we do write in our journals, we can see a lot of growth over the years.
Yeah.
So as a COO, you're right up there with the CEO, overseeing the operations of the company. For our listeners who may be unfamiliar with what a COO does, could you give us a brief glimpse of what a day in the life of a COO looks like?
Yeah, I'll do my best. As you said in the intro, COO stands for Chief Operating Officer, probably widely understood, but maybe some don't understand that. And the COO reports directly to the CEO, the Chief Executive Officer. And in many cases, and in this case where I work now, the CEO is also the owner of the company. It's his company, it's his vision, and I do my best to help with that vision, but ultimately it's my goal to be the integrator. So if he's the visionary and I am the integrator, then it's my job to take what may appear somewhat ambiguous and then turn that into a clear and concise plan that our company can roll out. And I don't do it on my own. I've put together an executive committee and we meet all the time. I meet with our vice presidents every week in a one-on-one and find out what obstacles they have in their pathway that I can help clear. And I follow up with them on their metrics. And they do the same with the people that report to them. So as a group, we're very intentional about our annual and quarterly goals, and we do our best to share the vision and strategy with every member of the company. And so creating clarity, sharing clarity, getting people kind of excited throughout the company, that falls on my shoulders.
Which I feel like would be a very big responsibility, especially if it's going to be over a large amount of employees. And do you guys have like a large amount that you have to oversee and keep up with?
We have 117 employees today. It's our ambition for year over year growth to be at about 175 to 200 employees in the next 3 to 4 years. And so we think we've stumbled on something that's very special for people. We feel good about our core purpose, which is to improve the lives of our employees, customers, and vendors. And we're really genuine about that. So we want to bring as many people under the shade of this tree as possible, because we want to help. You know, we really do have some altruistic ideas about how we can help people move along and enjoy their lives.
Yeah. And I know that may require like a lot of innovation and finding new and better ways for the operation and helping people better their lives. So for you, what does your personal process of innovation look like?
Yeah, that's a good question. The construction industry is changing drastically, and innovation plays a huge role. What people 15, 20 years ago would have experienced in the construction industry is wildly different than what we're experiencing now, which is, again, way different than what the next generation will do, because of the implementation of innovation through software and automation. To keep up with that personally, I read a lot. I hated reading in college. I hated cracking my textbooks. And I spend most of my day reading. I process well over 100 emails a day. And then I try and read several books a year and the right kinds of articles and stay in touch with what's going on, so we can sift through what makes sense for us and what we should ignore. But that's a big part of, you know, what I need to do. And I invite our leadership to be really, really honest about where we're not as healthy as a company, so that we can identify what innovations are most critical. We can't sit around a conference table and pat each other on the shoulders and say everything's great, we don't need to innovate. But we can't sit around the conference table and complain about everything and suggest that there's nothing that is unique or great about our company. So it's kind of finding that white space where you can put your niche in the market and profit, but understand always what you can do to make things better through technology, automation, improved ideology that's coming out of school. And so I'm doing my best along those lines.
Yeah, definitely requires a lot of adaptation to everything that's always changing year to year, I feel like. So as one of the executives in your company, what are some of the other issues facing your field and or the business environment in general?
Well, I'll speak specifically about the construction industry, although I think that these thoughts will parlay well into some other industries. Our single largest challenge is finding skilled labor. That would be the same whether you were in my industry, which is steel fabrication, industrial services, or if you owned a plumbing company or an electrician company, or you were building trusses or whatever it is. Finding skilled labor is really, really hard. For the last few generations, you know, parents have been telling kids you need to go to school so that you can get a good job. And that's not bad advice, but it's created a shortage on people who want to get out in the sun and build America, you know. And so there's a real dearth of people that have unique skills to weld or connect steel or whatever it is. And so that's our single greatest challenge. I think the leaders of tomorrow are going to need to be really, really creative in filling the skill gap. We hire people who match our core values and appreciate our purpose, and then we hope to give them a skill. But as soon as you give someone a skill, they're so valuable in the market, you've got to be really good at retaining them as well, because if you're not, they'll take what you've given them and leave and make more money somewhere else. So That's our single biggest challenge. We're working really hard on it.
Yeah. And when you mentioned your company's core values, I actually looked on your website about those, and I saw that it's happy, hungry, as in seeking learning opportunities, hardworking, and honorable. And I think those are great core values just for any kind of workplace. How would you say is the best way to implement those personally?
Yeah, Spencer, that's a good question. First of all, it's to be those things. When you create your executive team, You cannot create that team with people that don't personify those values. When we hire and we're in the recruiting process, it plays a big role in the conversations that we have with prospective employees. And when we're looking at prospective clients, it plays a big role. We're looking for partners who mirror those values. But we've got banners everywhere. We put out a newsletter every other week, and we share things that are happening and some kind of motivational thoughts along the lines of our core values. We've got wall vinyl in our conference room and in several other rooms. So they're reminders everywhere. And I have seen people that in the very beginning, I did not think were going to adapt well to this. And frankly, I thought they probably wouldn't be a part of the company much longer. And then I see this kind of shift in how they experience work when these core values are present. And then they become those core values themselves, not just at work, but then I hear stories about how they are when they go home as, you know, dad or mom or husband or wife. And I'm just really proud of the personal progress that's come from our implementation of these core values.
Yeah, I think they are very versatile in applying to outside of work life. And I love how you mentioned that example, because I think when we think of work and the things that we learn there, especially within a work culture, we kind of think of it just to be in that mindset of work, but it can also be applied to outside of work, especially within family life. So I thought that was a really great example. Speaking of family life and shifting gears a little bit, many in our audience are about to or have recently started their families. And we always love to know with our guest, what has worked for you in regards to maintaining work-life balance and contributing at home as well as at work?
That's probably the most important thing we can talk about, right? Young families are just so precious, and there's so much at stake. And newlyweds spend their first, you know, months or years learning about each other. You take on a little of her history, and he takes on a little of your history, and or she takes on a little of your history, and together you make this future that's culturally unique, and it's your own. It's a little bit of where you were before as individuals, but it's more about where you are now, where you're going. So it just evolves with time. But when you add a child to it, your world is just turned upside down, and it's hard, but it's the best thing ever. It's so hard. And so it's better to start your family when you're young and naive, I think. You know, you're never really going to be ready, but you're always going to be capable. Heavenly Father's created us to be successful parents. But don't think for a minute that you can read enough books to keep you calm when your baby's not sleeping well and your career is demanding your focus and your wife looks like she wants to cry because she's lost her identity. But it's worth it, Spencer. So as long as we're as committed to marriage as we are to the person that we married, it's going to be fine. My wife's a saint. I mean, she's a rock. And no success or failure that I've ever had has occurred without her support and hard work and love. But that quest for balance, it's not going to come right away. For us, it didn't mean backing away from responsibilities at home or at work or at church. It really meant kind of putting the pedal down hard and even overcommitting sometimes. So we committed to coaching sports and home evenings and school field trips and, you know, going to all the ball games and ballet recitals. And so when I look at young couples now, I just want to hug them because it's hard, but you figure it out. You just figure it out. You'll make mistakes and you'll overcommit, but staying at home to watch The Bachelor while the baby stays on a sleep routine is not going to move the ball for anyone.
Absolutely. That I think a lot of BYU young newlyweds would really appreciate that advice and what you just said. It does require a lot of teamwork. On another note, your son, Mitch Harris, correct? He played football here at BYU. Do you have any advice on how to raise a future college athlete for any BYU students who also want their children to play at BYU?
Sure, I could do my best there. As we sat in the stands for 4 years in a row, surrounded by the other parents, and I am a student of people, I love to observe and see commonalities and differences. I did notice some things. For me, I was a mediocre high school athlete, and I just love what sports do for people to work hard and learn to win and lose. But I'll tell you, my wife is insanely competitive. I mean, she hates losing. You better be wearing safety goggles if you beat her in a board game, because pieces are going to be flying. So what occurred in our family and what I saw that was common as we're sitting there in the parent section is these moms they're wildly competitive, probably more so than the dads. And so if you want your kid to grow up and be a Division I athlete, you better get really involved. You probably need to spend some time coaching so that you can develop a really solid relationship where your child will receive constructive feedback, both praise and not praise. If they're not welcome, then you're not making progress. But the bottom line is this: if mom's not in it, it's not happening. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of ball touches that those young men on the field or the court or the young women on the field or court have had way before they played Division I sports. And that's because typically it's mom is signing them up and taking them to a lot of practices and sits on a sideline and chews her fingernails while things are not going great, is cheering when things are going great. But there was a very consistent pattern in the parent section. If you want to raise a barn in a day, round up all the football moms and then just get out of the way, let the dads do the barbecuing.
Yeah, I've been to my fair share of high school football games, and I have seen a lot of that, so that is very true. Yeah. Well, Brett, thank you so much for your insights and comments up to this point. As you know, our podcast is called Measuring Success Right. We love hearing different definitions of what success is. So one question that we like to ask each of our guests as we wrap up is, how do you personally measure success?
It's easy to measure success for a company on a profit and loss statement, but that's not where it starts. And it's really not a true indicator of what led up to success, right? It's several preliminary successes that matter most that lead to that. So for me, when I see an aha moment for a young technician or get real buy-in from an aspiring leader, and I can tell someone's just really committed to a pattern of discipline that's going to benefit them at home and in their career, I just get really excited. And so that's where, I and my team put a lot of energy is into the personal development of the individuals that spend a lot of time here trading work for a paycheck. We're doing our best to develop leaders and people that are compassionate and careful and diligent and really want success for themselves and for the team. And these changes in people are more nuanced than obvious, but if you're really spending the time to get to know them and individual conversations and coaching, you see it and it's inspiring. And when you see those that report to you or report to someone below you make real change, it inspires me in my position, encourages me to keep doing my best. I don't want when they're working that hard, I certainly don't want to be the one to let anybody down. But to me, I'm measuring success in the more nuanced ways.
Absolutely. Brett, thank you so much again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. This is Spencer McWilliams with Measuring Success Right. Have a wonderful week.
Make sure you subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or SoundCloud so you never miss an episode. Be a friend and tell a friend about Measuring Success Right.
This podcast is a project of the Marriott Student Review at Brigham Young University. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Marriott Student Review or online at marriottstudentreview.org.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect official policy or position of Brigham Young University or The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.